Back in December, when President Obama announced he was sending additional troops to Afghanistan, he said something we don't hear too often from the White House.
We can't simply afford to ignore the price of these wars.
Foreign policy professor Michael Mandelbaum says that's a rare admission for an American president and that it could signal a new phase of foreign policy for the U.S. Mandelbaum explores that topic in a new book called The Frugal Superpower: America's Global Leadership in a Cash-Strapped Era. Mandelbaum argues that with the current economic crisis and the need to pay out vast amounts of Social Security and Medicare benefits down the line, we just won't be able to afford the kind of interventions we've made in the past. He says a lot of American foreign policy over the past six decades has been driven by one thing: we're rich.
For almost all of history, almost every country, when it decided on a foreign policy, had to ask first and foremost how much it would cost. But we've been so wealthy since really the beginning of World War II in 1941 that that question really has not been all that important. We've asked, what's right for the world? What can we do to make the world a better place? What international duties do we have? Well, with all of the obligations coming down the road, with all the costs that we're going to have to pay, the American taxpayer is really going to be strapped and stretched. And the taxpayer is going to say, wait a minute, before we undertake any foreign policy, let's think hard about how much it will cost. And that's a question that really hasn't been uppermost in our minds, well, as I say, since the beginning of World War II. And that means that we are entering a very different period in American foreign policy from the one that we've all known.
And it sounds like you're saying there's going to be a change in what it means for America to be a global leader in a way. What has sort of been the things we've done that have defined that particular role?
Well, for all of the criticism that the United States receives around the world and in the United States, I believe, and I say in the book, that America's international role has been very, very constructive. In fact, I compare what the United States has done in the role to what governments do within the countries they govern. I think the United States has in some ways been the world's de facto government and has provided governmental services, and that has helped keep the world prosperous and secure.
I mean, some people might be scared when they hear de facto government for the world. So tell us, what does that actually mean in terms of the nitty-gritty? What are you saying here?
Well, it is a kind of striking thing to say. But what I mean is, for example, the United States provides the world with its currency, the dollar. The United States has been the world's consumer of last resort. Countries that want to export in order to prosper have been able to export to us. And the United States has played a kind of policing role around the world, most importantly in East Asia and in Europe. Those are what I believe are the, let's call them, quasi-governmental services that will come under pressure in the decades ahead. And that won't be good for the world. In fact, the negative effects may be harsher for other countries than they are for us.
But I cover Congress, and to see a discussion on the floor of the House or the Senate about taking money away from defense initiatives or foreign policy initiatives, honestly, I guess I don't really see what you're saying here. There's always this sense of that's the untouchable part of the budget.
A very good point. And what I'm predicting in this book is that that is going to change. It's going to change when it turns out that we can no longer borrow the money we need to pay out Social Security and Medicare. When that happens, people are going to have to pay higher taxes and they're going to have to forego some benefits. And when that happens, people are going to say, yes, we'd like to have as big a defense budget as possible, but if the choice is between paying out the defense budget and paying out what we are owed in Medicare, we're going to opt for Medicare. We're going to choose domestic spending rather than international spending. And you already see some straws in the wind. For example, we have seen Secretary of Defense Gates talk quite boldly about making reductions in defense spending because he can see what's coming. He understands that there's going to be enormous pressure on the American taxpayer.
I was surprised to read in your book that your sort of solution to the changes that are coming was a gas tax.
Yes, this is the one policy proposal in the frugal superpower. We will reach a point in the United States where there will be a consensus the taxes must go up. And then the question will be not whether to raise taxes, but rather what taxes to raise. And if you ask that question, a gasoline tax looks not exactly good, but less bad than the alternatives to it.
Michael Mandelbaum, you've talked a lot about the limitations that this new sort of cash-strapped era will bring. But, I mean, really, what should the role be for America, I guess, in this environment?
I hope that it will be possible for the United States to continue many of the important international roles that it plays. I do not think we will be able to do everything that we have done for the past several decades.
Michael Mandelbaum is head of the American Foreign Policy Program at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, and he's the author of a new book, The Frugal Superpower, America's Global Leadership in a Cash-Strapped Era. Michael Mandelbaum, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Lots of animals yelp or cry out when they're in pain. But as far as scientists can tell, humans seem to be the only species that sheds tears for emotional reasons. As part of our series on evolution, The Human Edge, NPR's Allison Aubrey explores whether the uniquely human act of weeping gives us some advantage.
Actors have a few tricks to help them cry on cue. There's the fresh chopped onion, which will really get the tear ducts going. And there are glycerin drops, a soap opera technique for coaxing those big, beautiful tears that roll down the cheeks. That's because it's really hard to cry unless you're really feeling something.
Crying has to come from emotion, right? That's where we all cry from anyway.
Jane Daly is an actress as well as a longtime acting instructor. She says tears come not only from grief or pain, they flow from all sorts of emotions.
Joy, the birth of a baby, and frustration. Tears of frustration. They can be cathartic and releasing. It's what makes us completely human.
Tears are universal, and think about it for a minute. We need them to keep our eyes lubricated. But why on earth should streams of salty drops spew forth from our eyes, blurring our vision, making our eyes puffy, when we get emotional? Scientists who study evolution say crying probably conferred some benefit, did something to advance our species, because it's stayed with us. Looking back at our early human ancestors, psychologist Randy Cornelius of Vassar College says his hunch is that crying may have evolved as a kind of signal, a signal that was valuable because it could only be picked up by those closest to us who could actually see our tears.
You can imagine that there would be selection pressure to develop a signaling system that wouldn't let predators in on the fact that you're vulnerable, but that would let your intimates in, you know, somebody within a couple of feet of you who can see what's going on, and so then try to help.
To this day, tears continue to play an important role in communication. And the extraordinary thing is that tears don't just telegraph our state of mind to others. They can also evoke strong emotions in the people who witness them. We've all experienced at some point that we not only cry from our own pain, but we're moved to tears by other people's sadness.
I like to use the word empath. I think a lot of people know the word empathetic or empathy. There's sympathy and then there's empathy. Sympathy, you can feel sorry, you know, for somebody going through something terrible. Empathy or an empathic or empathetic person, i.e. a lot of actors, actually feel the darn thing.
Take Tom Hanks in the movie Saving Private Ryan. He plays a World War II Navy captain. In one scene, the company medic dies after desperate attempts to save his life. Hanks is overwhelmed.
He just breaks down sitting on an embankment on the side of a bridge at the loss, at another loss of a skilled, wonderful young man who barely had a chance to live. To see a grown man cry, it brings you to your knees.
And in that moment, we, the audience, feel it too. Witnessing these tears, we get choked up. And this is because as humans, one of our signature abilities is that we're able to put ourselves in someone else's shoes, to feel what someone else is feeling, predict how they might react, something academics call having a theory of mind.
So a theory of mind is something that even four-year-olds have. A theory of mind basically means that you have a theory about the unobservable psychological states that are governing or causing other people's behaviors.
Jesse Baring directs the Institute of Cognition and Culture at Belfast University. He says instinctively we pick up on gestures, facial expressions, body language, and that's just the beginning. He says this power of empathy is huge, and it's fundamental to pretty much everything we do, from forming close relationships to living in complex societies. Baring says those of our early ancestors who had the most empathy probably thrived because it helped them build strong communities, which gave them protection and support. Within these communities, Baring says tears could be powerful tools. They did more than just signal vulnerability. They were perhaps a way of keeping social and reproductive bonds strong. Maybe good criers were survivors.
Crying seems to elicit compassion and guilt, and that itself may be an evolved mechanism to save relationships that are in distress.
Baring says, take his own recent experience. Not long ago, he found out that his partner had cheated on him.
I mean, it was devastating, the fact that he cheated on me. And I was convinced that I was going to end the relationship right there.
But many apologies into a long conversation, his partner began to tear up.
He wasn't sobbing. It was not an hysterical cry. He was trying to choke back. He was trying to hide the fact that he was crying. And, you know, that was only through this discussion about our relationship and, you know, how much I had invested in it and how much he meant to me and how much he had hurt me. When I saw him cry, I realized that I was basically getting through to him.
Baring says he realizes that the tears did the heavy lifting here. The same conversation minus the tears may not have had the same effect. And Baring says this illustrates another aspect of crying. Whether it's intentional or unintentional, crying is a powerful way to get what you need or want. Think about how babies get your attention. They cry. And there's some evidence that natural selection favored infants whose cries were most alarming.
And as a consequence, these babies, who of course were our ancestors, would have been less likely to find themselves left alone or with strangers for long periods of time, and therefore less likely to befall genuine harm.
And crying can protect us throughout our lives. Just think about how you react when someone starts to cry.
I mean, just think about how difficult it is to punish somebody or to argue with somebody who's crying. I mean, it's like this sort of trigger that tells us to back off on that individual.
And tears don't often lie. Think about Tiger Woods and his public plea for sympathy after his extramarital affairs came to light.
I know I have bitterly disappointed all of you.
When he choked back tears, Men's Health editor Peter Moore says we all know where those tears were coming from.
They're kind of shameful tears. They're, I'm a dope, look at what an idiot I am, pity me tears. And I think that, you know, spare me. I just soon draw the curtain over that one.
And maybe that's another reason evolution has kept humans crying. Tears help reveal the truth. And that's because along with these tears, we've evolved a very sophisticated ability to interpret them. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
You can hear more about how empathy gave humans the edge this afternoon on All Things Considered, this time through the eyes of somebody who knows that her brain works differently, a woman with autism. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today in your health, the risks of birth control pills in a period when drug makers are advertising the pill as a drug that delivers more than contraception. This summer, the leading manufacturer of birth control pills, Bayer Healthcare, came out with a brand new pill called Natasia. The launch coincides with growing problems for Bayer's last contraceptive, Yaz. Thousands of women are suing the company because they say Yaz caused them serious harm. NPR's Richard Knox has our story.
When it came out 4 years ago, Yaz was something entirely new in the history of birth control pills, or at least in the marketing of birth control pills. Bayer sold Yaz as going beyond birth control.
All birth control pills are 99% effective and can give you shorter, lighter periods. But there's one pill that goes beyond the rest. It's Yaz, the pill more and more women are turning to.
The commercials imply Yaz is good for a slew of common problems. In the ad, bright balloons float away from carefree-looking young women. Each balloon bears the name of a symptom: moodiness, fatigue, headaches, acne.
And it also helps keep skin clear.
Those ads caught the attention of a 16-year-old in Maryland named Katie Anderson.
I do remember going to the gynecologist and asking for Yaz because I had seen the commercial. That's the one that I wanted.
She particularly liked the implication that Yaz could treat premenstrual syndrome, and the idea of clear skin appealed to her too.
What girl would not fall for something that says, you know, it's going to help with mild or moderate acne? That's great. That's just a perk. That's a plus.
So she got her doctor to write a prescription for Yaz. It's a choice she'd live to regret. We'll come back to Katie Anderson's story in a minute. First, let's hear from Ruth Day of Duke University. She advises the Food and Drug Administration on drug advertising. Day says she'd never seen a campaign that made such sweeping claims as those Yaz ads. She showed the ad to dozens of young women and asked what they thought.
Most people thought it was going to prevent all those symptoms, period.
For instance, 97% thought Yaz can treat ordinary premenstrual syndrome.
It does not. And the other question we asked, does it treat mild acne? And 64% said, yes, it does. But the truth is, it does not.
In fact, Yaz is approved only to treat a more serious and less common menstrual disorder, and only for more severe acne. By 2008, the FDA decided the Yaz ads were misleading and ordered Bayer to run a corrective commercial.
You may have seen some Yaz commercials recently that were not clear. The FDA wants us to correct a few points in those ads.
But Dave found the corrective ad still left a lot of people with the wrong message about what Yaz can and can't do. There's no question that Bayer's aggressive ad campaign worked. Yaz catapulted past all other birth control pills and became Bayer's top-selling drug. It brought the company $800 million last year. But one lesson from Yaz is be wary of claims that a potent pill will solve all your problems, something Katie Anderson learned the hard way. She began having persistent leg pains within a month of starting on Yaz.
I started developing this kind of pinching, twinging, numbing kind of feeling in my left butt cheek.
She thought it was a pinched nerve. Then, a couple of weeks later, she was awakened with terrible chest pain.
She tells me she woke up at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and she sat bolt upright in bed, couldn't move, couldn't talk, was trying to cry as silently as possible because it hurt to breathe.
That's Beth Anderson, Katie's mom.
I went to check on her, and I found her sitting in a puddle of tears, saying, "Mommy, I can't breathe. Mommy, I can't breathe."
Her doctor diagnosed pleurisy, inflammation of the chest lining, which isn't serious. He prescribed a painkiller. But over the next few days, it got hard for Katie to breathe, and her left leg went totally numb and cold.
My left leg was completely purple.
It turns out there was an enormous clot in her leg. A piece of it had broken off and lodged in her lung. Doctors call that a pulmonary embolism, and it can be deadly. Beth Anderson took Katie to the emergency room.
And the doctor came in and he took one look at Katie's cold blue leg and he said, "Wow, that's a big blood clot. You're in birth control, aren't you?"
The link between birth control pills and blood clots isn't new. It's been known for decades. Every year, a few thousand women suffer clots because they're on the pill. But it's possible that Yaz and Yasmin, a similar pill, carry a higher risk of clotting. Danish researchers decided to compare the experience of millions of women taking different contraceptives. They found those taking Yaz and Yasmin had a 64% higher risk of blood clots than women taking pills that had been around for decades. That's not a dramatically higher risk, but it's worrisome given the millions of women taking the pills.
Well, the safest is actually still, surprisingly, one of the oldest pills.
That's Dr. Fritz Rosendahl of Leiden University in Holland, an expert in blood clotting disorders. He led another study that also found women using Yaz have a higher risk of clotting than those on older pills, about twice as high.
There are convincing indications this pill is less safe than other pills.
Bayer says its research shows Yaz is no riskier than other contraceptives. The FDA found flaws in the Danish and Dutch studies, so it's funding its own research. But on one point, there's no controversy. Some women have a much higher risk of clotting and death when they take birth control pills, and most of them don't know it. Katie Anderson's mom did know that a superclotting gene ran in her family, and she pointed that out to Katie's doctor.
I wanted to make sure that that wasn't going to be an issue, and she said it is. She was not aware that there was any specific problem with that.
It turned out that Katie had the gene, too. It made her 35 times more likely to have a problem. Yaz might have made that even higher. The labels of all birth control pills warn women not to take them if they have a family history of clotting, but often that's not mentioned in TV ads. The ones for Yaz simply warn that women over 35 shouldn't smoke because that increases the risk of blood clots.
Both Katie and I assumed that since she was well under 35, she wasn't overweight, and she had never smoked, that it would be safe. And we assumed wrong.
Katie is now one of 2,700 women suing Bayer over Yaz. 3 years later, she's left with a massive clot in her leg. She can't hike or be on her feet for long. The clot may never go away. Katie Anderson's experience shows how important it is to pay attention to warnings about bad side effects. And doctors should, too. Birth control pills are a serious business. They carry real risks. And now Bayer's introducing Natasia, another new birth control pill. This happens over and over again, especially when there's an enormous market like the one for birth control pills. Companies keep coming up with new versions and selling them as different and better. The pressure is even greater when lawsuits or competition from generics have eaten into sales. Dr. Edio Zampaglione of Bayer is in charge of the new pill. He says the company developed it simply because women need more options.
Each woman is different, and each woman will feel differently on these hormones and will react differently to them.
To some, those highly individual reactions are an argument for caution, because when a new birth control pill comes out, no one knows how it will affect millions of different women. And Natasia is really different. Like Yaz, it contains a hormone that's never been used in a birth control pill, and it has a novel dosing regimen, too. Beth Anderson says Katie's story contains a final lesson for women tempted to take the new pill.
Really, the moral of the story is that you shouldn't use the latest and greatest drugs unless there's some reason that the ones that have been around don't work for you.
Rosendahl, the Dutch clotting expert, agrees.
Because we know that all drugs have side effects, and we also know that for newer ones, which have not yet been used by millions of people, the side effects are generally unknown.
Bayer is monitoring how its new pill is doing in tens of thousands of women, but results of those studies won't be in for at least 5 years. Richard Knox, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer in for Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Voters in four states across the country go to the polls tomorrow to choose candidates for the November election. It's a year in which anti-Washington feelings are running high, and anti-establishment candidates have scored some victories. NPR's Cokie Roberts joins us now, as she often does on Monday mornings, to tell us what to look for in these primaries. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
And Cokie, before we get to the particulars of those primary races, I want to ask about the politics of the war in Iraq. This month, of course, the administration pulled out its last combat brigade. Iraq was a big issue back in 2006, the last major midterm election. Is it an issue at all this year?
It barely registers. When voters are asked to list the most important issues facing the country going into this election, about 6, 7, 8%, depending on the poll, cite the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. And as you say, in 2006, going into that election, Iraq was always right at the top of the list. And that's, of course, when the Democrats came to power, and it was really the issue that launched Barack Obama's presidential campaign. So you might expect a little more fanfare as the last combat troops leave Iraq. But of course, it's so muddy, Renee. 50,000 troops will still be there and in harm's way. And that question of combat status is somewhat a semantic one. But there's no question the violence is way down. And yesterday on CBS, the commander in Iraq, General Ray Odierno, was asked if we had won this war.
I would say that we've made lots of progress here. I would say to determine whether we've won the war or not, we can see that in 3 to 5 years. As we see how Iraq turns out, a strong democratic Iraq will bring stability to the Middle East. And if we see Iraq that's moving towards that 2, 3, 5 years from now, I think we can call our operations a success.
That's hardly a victory statement. It's not one of defeat either. It's the much messier time will tell. And General Odierno did raise the specter of troops staying longer than the total drawdown of 2011 if they're needed. If they asked, the U.S. would consider it, he said.
And President Obama is scheduled to make a speech on Iraq when he gets back from vacation. Would this be a moment for him to take credit for a success? And is that something he can realistically do?
Well, I doubt it. I think he seems to want to signal, of course, that this moment of drawdown is important, that he will mark it in a major way. And the vice president today is going to the Veterans of Foreign Wars. But it's a somewhat awkward subject for the president. He ran against the war in Iraq. He argued against the troop buildup called the surge. A lot of people credit that buildup for the more secure situation in Iraq today. So I think the president can't exactly take credit for success such as it is. He can say that he kept his promise to bring the troops out, which he's been alluding to on the campaign trail. And he'll certainly honor the men and women who have fought there and certainly those who were killed there without necessarily endorsing the policy that put them in Iraq in the first place. It's a balancing act. But as we said earlier, it's also not an issue the voters are thinking very much about right now.
Yes, what the voters are thinking about right now is the economy. And in earlier primaries in past years, some pretty influential incumbents have lost their seats over a bad economy. Are we likely to see more of that anti-incumbent anger in tomorrow's primaries?
Well, it doesn't look like it, but that's partly because the big fight is in Florida, where that anti-establishment feeling already played out in the Republican Party, where Governor Charlie Crist, running for the Senate, decided to not run as a Republican anymore because he was being so seriously challenged by conservative Mark Rubio. So it looks like Rubio will be the Republican candidate. Crist will be the independent candidate. The fight is on the Democratic side, where wealthy businessman Jeff Green just poured tons of his own money into a campaign against Congressman Kendrick Meek. But Meek, at the moment, looks like he's likely to pull it out. He has had the endorsements of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, and Bill Clinton's backing was considered absolutely crucial for the incumbent in his home state, Blanche Lincoln, running for the Senate. Unlike the endorsement tomorrow of Sarah Palin for Lisa Murkowski in her home state of Alaska, Palin backed Murkowski's opponent. Murkowski is running well ahead. But Palin's endorsement in Arizona of her old running mate John McCain might be helping him there.
Cokie, thanks very much. NPR's Cokie Roberts.